Welcome. For those of you still getting your food and beverage, take your time, then feel free to come join us. And welcome to everyone that's joining us online today. Good morning, afternoon, evening, whatever time of day it might be where you are. Thank you for joining us. I'm Kristen Oplanik, and I work for USAID in the Bureau of Economic Growth, Education, and Environment. And we are so pleased to host a special MicroLinks event today in partnership with Save the Children. We love when members of the MicroLinks community have new evidence to share that can improve the impact of all of our programs. Today that evidence comes out of the Youth Save program, and we have two excellent panels planned to dig into the details of what they found to share with you. But first, we're going to show a short video that will provide you with an overview of the Youth Save project. Through the stories of four youth from Colombia, Ghana, Kenya, and Nepal, the video will provide a background frame for our deeper conversations today. Enjoy.
Mi nombre es Naim. Tengo 14 años y vivo aquí en Santa Rosa.
My name is Mercy and I'm 13 years old.
My name is Rijana and I'm 16 years old. In order to prepare for secondary school, I have to find job for myself. My mother don't have enough money to take care of her.
How do you transition into being productive adults? You want to make sure that people who are younger than you become adults who are contributing to the society.
So how can we as youth development professionals and public policy people and donors and yes, even commercial financial institutions give youth a tangible stake in their future? Some reason to think that if they work hard, they can actually realize some of those dreams. So what difference does it make if you offer a group of young people the opportunity to save in a bank account? What difference can that make to their lives? Does it change their behavior? Does it give them more hope for the future? What's the impact over time of a low-income young person having access to a savings account?
Youth Save is a program that teaches children how to save and how to manage their savings.
Con Youth Save abrí una cuenta en el banco. Este programa me enseñó muchas cosas acerca del ahorro. Mi mamá me da para la merienda y yo ahí saco y ahorro.
Every month I gather the money, then I bring it to the bank and save some so that I can go to secondary school. I want to be a nurse.
I started saving money in 2012. When I grow up, I would like to be a lawyer.
It's basically giving them financial education so they can better manage their lives in future.
It changes their perspective. They become more responsible persons. They become respectful. They have seen that the savings is going to improve their life in future.
They started thinking about who will I be in the future? What will my future look like? Their self-confidence and their self-efficacy goes up, and so they engage better in school.
You know, when we first started this project and we went into the communities and we started talking about what we were doing, we were confronted with some skepticism. Skepticism about the fact that young people could save, that it was a good thing for them to save. But if you offer a good saving service and really listen to what kids say that they need and want, our data indicates that, yes, even low-income young people can save money.
Giving more low-income youth the opportunity to have secured platforms to save gives them the opportunity to access their dreams or to live their dreams.
Cuando sea grande, quiero ser pintor. O juntando mi alcancía es un granito de arena para mi futuro.
When I deposit my money, I feel like I'm working to get to my dream.
I've working for 8 months now, so I have enough money to go to secondary school. And today I went to the office to choose the school that I wanted to go. My day today is a good day. Yeah.
Good morning. My name is Ronnie Deshpande, and it's been my privilege to serve as the project director for YouthSave since its founding in 2010. And on behalf of the entire YouthSave Consortium, I'm so pleased that so many of you could join us both here in person and via the web to hear about the last 5 years of our work. There are so many people whose contributions have been critical to making this work a success, some of whom are here in the room with us today, including from the founding organizations, the Center for Social Development at Washington University, CGAP, New America, of course, our valuable supporter, the MasterCard Foundation, and my own organization, Save the Children. But many more, actually, who are in the countries where we actually did our work, at our partner organizations, including Banco Caja Social and Uniandes in Colombia, at HFC Bank and ESER in Ghana, at Kenya Post Bank and KIPRA in Kenya, and at the New Era Research Group and Bank of Kathmandu in Nepal. Though they're not physically here with us today, we'd be highly remiss if we didn't acknowledge and thank them for their tireless efforts in enabling YouthSave experimentation and the learning that came from it. Those learnings and their implications are what we'll be focusing on today. Our morning will be divided into two main parts. From 9:30 to 10:45, we'll be hearing about the findings of the seminal research that was such a big part of YouthSave, both in terms of the immediate outcomes and the broader impacts for youth well-being. Then, after a quick break, we'll reconvene from 11 to about 12:15 to discuss what these and other operational lessons from the project mean for various stakeholders who are in a position to increase the availability and high-quality saving services for low-income people, including donors, practitioners, and policymakers. And finally, we'll hear from the Ford Foundation about where YouthSave figures in the long history of work on asset building for children and youth, and what else remains to be done. But before that, I'd like to introduce someone who'll be able to give you a bird's eye view of what YouthSave really was, both as an independent project and in the context of a whole field of efforts to increase the financial inclusion of young people. Ruth Duick-Nbeba is a microfinance development and business professional with more than 30 years of experience in public accounting, financial reporting, management, training, consulting on three continents. As YouthSave's program manager at the MasterCard Foundation for the past 3 years, she has also been a trusted counselor, a sage strategist, and a thoughtful voice insisting on both the performance and the potential of our joint work. At YouthSave, we are privileged to call her a true partner. Please join me in welcoming Ruth Duick-Nbeba.
Good morning. Thank you, Ronnie. And thank you for being here and for this opportunity on this very exciting day and event when we want to celebrate, reflect on YouthSave and what it has accomplished. When the YouthSave Consortium embarked on this ambitious project in 2010, many were very skeptical about the relevance, scope, and need for such an endeavor. Why the focus on young people and on savings? Why test hypotheses with commercial banks? What were we hoping to learn, and how would the results be used? As the largest initiative on youth savings in developing countries, and one of the first, YouthSave set out to answer many fundamental questions and explore several key assumptions. Working together as a consortium, multidisciplinary organizations addressed the commercial potential, undertook rigorous research, promoted youth engagement, and reflected on policy implications. As Ronnie shared, the project worked in 4 countries, Colombia, Ghana, Kenya, and Nepal, and in each country worked with a large commercial bank. Save the Children worked with local partners and banks to offer financial education and conducted youth risk monitoring activities. in partnership with the Center for Social Development and the University of North Carolina, local researchers worked with the banks and gained consent from 70,000 young people and their guardians to provide account and demographic information. In Ghana, the local research partner, together with UNC and with CSD, conducted a rigorously constructed evaluation and experiment on over 6,000 young people, trying to understand and test the results of program participation on financial capability, savings outcomes, psychological, health, and educational outcomes. CGAP and New America contributed to business case analysis and policy discussions with partners and local stakeholders. And today, after 5 years of implementation, research, and learning, we believe that the Youth Save Initiative has never been more relevant or timely. There are currently an estimated 1.8 billion young people in the world between 15 and 24. They need access to financial services now and in the future. And at the MasterCard Foundation, we believe that a savings culture will help young people develop good financial behaviors and will have an impact on the choices they make as they transition to adulthood. The foundation works with visionary organizations to provide greater access to education, skills training, economic opportunities, and financial services for people living in poverty, primarily in Africa. And as one of the largest independent foundations, its work is guided by the mission to advance learning and promote financial inclusion in order to alleviate poverty. So the Youth Save Project sits perfectly at the intersection of two of our three areas of work, financial inclusion and youth livelihoods. And it also touches on a third area of activity, education and learning. From the beginning, the foundation has seen the Youth Save Project as one of the more exciting ones that we have supported, not only because of its unique design, but because of the wealth of knowledge it was intended to create and has now generated. And when we began more than 5 years ago, we all had an image of what this could look like. Overall, we set out to test youth savings products and banks, to document and to learn about the attitudes and practices of disadvantaged young people in a handful of countries. We have sought to understand what it takes for commercial banks to consider the segment of young people as customers. In a way, it was a leap of faith. And with you, Youth Save, we took a bet, postulating that if the right savings products and services were offered to disadvantaged youth, young people would actually open accounts, and it would encourage good savings behaviors. We didn't know when we began that we'd see such enthusiasm for the project with the banks. To be fair, we didn't know about some of the obstacles that they would face as well. We also set out to understand youth savings in a broader context, possibly as a tool for social protection strategies. Even more, could savings accounts contribute positively and sustainably to youth development and to financial inclusion in development countries? We helped financial service providers to design products, and then we watched what happened. What have we learned? Firstly, at the time the project was launched, many thought that poor young people don't have money, therefore they don't save. That myth has been busted. We have learned that young people have money. They are financially active. They save. They opened over 130,000 savings accounts, accumulating well over $1 million in savings after 3 years of rollout. We learned that they want access to banking products that are simple, easy to use, easy to understand, and have a measure of privacy and independence in operating them. They also want to save for their future, such as a large investment for education, or to help their family, but also to have easy access to fund emergencies. Secondly, we wanted to know what combination of products and services, marketing strategies could help lead to profitability, sustainability, and commercial adoption. We confirmed that there is no short or medium-term business case for small balance young savers, using traditional branch-based bank models. The advance of digital financial services in the past 5 years has introduced innovations that could change the economics significantly. And although the project did not explore other models, we did learn valuable insights about how to build the business case regardless of the model. It is important to understand how a financial provider builds value for its future customers, how it creates lifetime loyalty, under what market conditions and with which institutional capabilities. And we'll hear more about that this morning. Thirdly, when we launched the project, many in the financial sector did not believe that young people need unique products or special outreach from a commercial bank. We were curious about what product and service characteristics would work for young people. What would motivate young people, account holders, to open accounts? What incentives make an impact on account uptake or use? And we learned how broad access for youth is possible across gender, age, groups, and income levels. We learned that many things matter: parental support, bank outreach, physical proximity, product characteristics, incentives for both customers and banks, savings reminders. All these factors can influence access and usage. Fourthly, we wanted to know whether financial education mattered and made a difference in youth knowledge, skills, attitudes, and behaviors. Save the Children conducted financial education activities in 3 of the 4 countries to teach young people about sound personal financial management and how to use a savings account. In the tests and evaluations that they conducted on knowledge, attitudes, and behavior, they found improvements in participant values related to savings, attitudes towards banks, and knowledge about some of the technical aspects of saving. After training, a greater number of youth reported saving and saving more. Fifthly, we wanted to explore what impact a youth savings account might have on the psychological, social, health, and educational outcomes of young people. And the Ghana experiment that we'll hear about tested the effects of in-school banking and general bank marketing on account uptake, balances, and development outcomes. We learned that in-school banking and marketing initiatives can significantly improve account uptake, deposits, and savings accumulation when compared with the control group. Youth in the treatment group also use the banks more than putting money under their mattress or in the piggy bank. Results on psychological health and social outcomes, however, were mixed or modest, and we hope to explore more of these findings today. Lastly, we asked questions about the importance and relevance of context. We learned that context does matter for youth and for the banks, and that this may have policy implications. For instance, in Colombia and Nepal, the legal age of maturity to open accounts is 7 and 16 years respectively, lowering the entry barriers for young people in those countries. Most of the banks also innovated using alternate identification documents. They involved trusted adults, whether parents, guardians, or school teachers, to help young people open and transact on accounts. And these practices have set precedents in the 4 countries. Providing access to bank accounts in schools especially helped to increase access for young girls in contexts where they generally enjoy less mobility. We also learned that national strategies and market dynamics can drive account uptake. For example, Kenya's National Blueprint for Growth and Development, Vision 2030, was a strong driver behind the savings agenda for the Kenyan bank partner. It also coincided with their own bank strategy of refreshing their aging customer base. In Nepal, the partner bank had a mass market vision that drove its strategy to reach youth on a national basis. In Nepal, the national financial education strategy also required that all banks offered financial education for their customers starting in 2013. Today, Financial inclusion is front and center in the global development agenda. This is evidenced by the Maya Declaration, G20 statements, global commitments by development leaders who have made it a pillar of the national development strategy of nearly every country. In each of the four countries of USAID, financial inclusion has become a focus of public policy and private sector action, especially financial inclusion for youth and marginalized populations. The youth agenda is also incorporated as a priority area of work in the new Sustainable Development Goals. At the MasterCard Foundation, we believe that all young people deserve the opportunity to build assets, gain knowledge, and develop sound financial habits. We believe that families, communities, public, private, and civil society stakeholders all need to play a role in giving young people the opportunity to save and to save early in life. We also believe that they need a broader set of comprehensive supports, the appropriate skills, mentorship, employment, or entrepreneurship options for more successful and sustainable transitions to adulthood. So what does the future hold? As you can already surmise, the success factors for the outcome and influence of a project like this at a practitioner, commercial, or policy level is highly subjective to context and conditions. From our point of view, perhaps the biggest learning is that, like a lot of things in life, when it comes to youth and savings and development outcomes, it really depends. There are a number of factors that it depends on. It depends on parents and guardians. We're seeing that in terms of both opening accounts and accumulating savings, parents play a critical role in the way that they can support young people. It depends on financial institutions, how they package and offer savings accounts. It depends on how they promote those accounts, how they market them. It depends on the outreach and the service delivery model. It also depends on the overall market. How competitive are financial service providers? How hungry are they to acquire new customers, even with upfront costs to do so? And how much do they see creating youth accounts as a stepping stone to future client retention? Finally, it depends on the policies and regulations from country to country. It depends on context. We do know that the results of YouthSave have generated useful learning for a broad range of stakeholders. A message to the commercial bank, heads up, young people do save. Over 130,000 opened accounts and four banks. Working with schools and communities has enabled banks to reach young people and could be an effective approach for the future. Embedding financial education in national school curriculum holds promise as a scalable solution as well. Reaching out-of-school young people, as well as those who are very vulnerable, will likely require subsidized holistic interventions from public or donor support. Building assets through a savings account can also influence and perhaps contribute to the hopes and aspirations of young people, in addition to generating the economic resources they need. In summary, it's quite clear that there are multiple and not singular pathways to helping young people and their futures. Today, the MasterCard Foundation congratulates the YouthSave Consortium for what it has achieved, what it has accomplished, and what we've all been allowed to be a part of and learn with you. Final research and learning publications are completed, and we really encourage you to browse the rich library that this body of work has produced. Today, we're also very pleased to launch the publication findings from a global financial inclusion partnership just out, hot off the press. It summarizes the learnings and lessons from the project of the past 5 years. We want to say thank you. Thank you to each one of you who played a part in this, and a hearty, really heartfelt congratulations for this labor of love for the past 5 years. It's been a journey of a very, very rich journey of enjoyment and ups and downs and learning. And here we are today, and we can start to reflect on what this all really means. We're very pleased today to introduce YouthSave and sector panelists to present learnings from the project, and we look forward to a rich discussion. Thank you again for coming and for participating.
Good morning, and sorry for the confusion there. I think we weren't sure if we were going to go sit in those comfortable chairs yet, or we're going to stay standing for a bit. But I'm Tricia Williams. I'm a manager in the Research, Evaluation, and Learning Department at the Foundation. I work closely with Ruth, and I won't echo all of her congratulatory remarks, but I will say that also at the among people in the Foundation beyond just Ruth, we're very excited about YouthSave and the results coming out of here. Oh, thank you. Yeah, I know. You have to move it up. So thank you to everyone who's here today, and thank you to everyone joining us on the web as well. One of the things we're particularly excited about at the Foundation was we recently published a research and evaluation policy. And one of the key principles of that policy is that research and learning is strategic and applied for impact. And I think just by virtue of us all being here, it's a good demonstration of that. We're excited to hear from Lissa and Gina, who I'll introduce, and really that we can think through about how this learning can impact our work in policy and practice. So first let me introduce Lissa. I'll also introduce Gina, and then Gina can follow directly after Lissa. But Lissa Johnson is a director of administration at the Center for Social Development at the Washington University in St. Louis. And as you've heard already from Ronnie and Ruth, this was a key member of the consortium, the YouthSave Consortium. So Lissa led the YouthSave Savings Demand Assessment, collecting and analyzing individual-level account data from financial institutions across the four countries. So we'll hear more from her about that. And, of course, Lissa has a very impressive career and involvement in many research projects, which I won't echo here, but you can read her bio on the web. And we're pleased to have her here with us. And after Lissa, we'll hear from Gina. And Dr. Gina Chawa is the Director of Global Social Development Innovations and an Associate Professor of Social Work at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She also holds faculty positions at Washington University in St. Louis and the University of Johannesburg. So Gina was the co-principal investigator of the YouthSave project, and she'll be speaking specifically about the results from the Ghana experiment. And we're very excited to have her here as well. She's involved in multiple research projects, and I'd encourage you to consult her full bio. Okay, so after they do their presentations, then we'll be glad to have some question and answer session. Okay, so all that, Lissa, come up. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Tricia. This has been a wonderful project, a lot of learning, and I want to thank MasterCard Foundation for their support of this. Okay. I am speaking about the Savings Demand Assessment today. I will be presenting data that has been collected on YouthSave account holders from product rollout, which was in 2012, through May of 2014, which was our last major data collection point. The Savings Demand Assessment answers three primary questions. First is, do youth open accounts? And corollary to that is, do low-income youth open accounts? Do the youth save in the accounts? And then, what are the characteristics that are associated with account opening and savings? And this morning, I'm going to focus primarily on this third question and distill some of the key findings from that. Excuse me. In the Savings Demand Assessment, we worked with the financial institutions, the research partners, to develop a few additional questions, some additional questions that went as a questionnaire into the account opening process. These were youth and household characteristics that we wanted to gather. We combined that information with the transactions, the deposits, withdrawals from the individuals, account holders, pulled out that information together. In addition to information we gathered about financial education and financial services that were being offered out in the field. And combined together, we have our four-country data set. So the first question is, do youth open accounts? Is that right? Yes. in the first, and remember, this is from data from 2014. At that point in time, we had 98,000 485 accounts open at that time. I make a distinction here between total accounts and research accounts. In research, we have to get consent for analyzing, collecting, analyzing, and reporting on data from the account holders. And so we have a subset of that that we are reporting on today, which is the 69,247 accounts. So our first question is, do low-income youth open accounts? to determine whether low-income youth are participating in this project, we adapted the poverty scorecard that was developed by Schreiner and colleagues, looking at poverty likelihood of individuals, and we find that 48% of the account holders are estimated to be living on $2.50 or less per day. The Youth Save Project also was focused on ages 12 to 18, and the financial institutions were able to attract youth during of that age. And the different countries, remember, as Ruth said, this is different context, so different countries had different results. But the average range by country was 12 years old was the average in Colombia, 14 in Ghana, and 16 in Kenya and Nepal. And in terms of gender, young girls girls did participate, as well as boys, by a ratio of 56 to 44. I will tell you that in Colombia, more the balance was pretty equal, and in Ghana, more girls opened accounts than boys. So now, what's our first question of what facilitated account uptake? We have two main factors that facilitated. The first one is based on account ownership and operation of the account. You can see that in Ghana and Kenya, the purple line shows a non-relative. And in Ghana and Kenya, both over 50% of accounts in Ghana and almost 50% in Kenya were opened by a non-relative. This reflects the trusted adults that were allowed to be opened, that were allowed to co-sign on the account instead of a parent or guardian. This was very successful in opening accounts. What's different about Nepal, you will see, is that the blue line shows you that these are the number of accounts opened by the youth themselves. So in Nepal, the age of majority is 16. So children are younger, the children who are 16 are younger and therefore are able to have account ownership. In Colombia, is not shown here, but youth as young as age 7 are able to open and own their own account as well. And this may explain why the age of 12, which is the average age of account owners in Colombia, is younger than in the other countries. The second factor that is very important and really cuts across all four countries is what we call taking the bank to the youth. The financial institutions use various marketing methods to attract the youth, and in this particular instance, the direct services to the schools and youth clubs really paid off and were particularly effective. What we did with the data is we analyzed in the branches that participated in those field services and find that branches that went out into the field opened more accounts than branches that did not. In Ghana, we looked at schools. And schools that were that received financial services in the schools opened more accounts than schools that did not have any such services. So there's two key advantages, three key advantages I'd like to mention about this. One is that as a basic piece, it's really easy for the youth to access and open accounts when the banks are coming to the schools, especially in rural areas where branches may not be readily available. This also facilitated, it's also more efficient way, an effective way for the financial institutions to reach large numbers of accounts. This you see reflected also in the public health world where vaccinations occur at the schools. It makes a lot of sense to reach the youth where the youth are. And thirdly, as was mentioned before, this facilitated the inclusion of more of the underserved. The financial institutions went out to low-income communities and were able to reach lower income and also more of the girls. Now let's turn to savings. Do the youth save? The total savings as of 2014 was $1.8 million that these young people saved across all four countries. The reason I like to use this graph is because it shows how savings fluctuates over time. However, it also shows, it points to the transaction patterns that also exist. So, for example, if you look at the red line, you can see where it steadily increases and the other lines tend to fluctuate. So identifying these kinds of patterns help us better understand the products and services that affect savings. So when we look at a little more detail of the transaction patterns, we see that in the youth in Colombia and Nepal tend to be more active transactors overall, both depositing and withdrawing. But what's particularly common in Nepal and Colombia, as I've mentioned, is both allow account ownership at a younger age. So age continues to show up as an important factor in all of this. In Nepal, you can see it has the most withdrawals. It also has the least withdrawal restrictions. So there may be some association there. In Ghana, Ghana has the least restriction, least number of withdrawals that were taken out, but it also happens to be the product that has the most restrictive withdrawal rules. So that also may reflect the steady line that we saw for Ghana, is that part of the saving is happening because the children are, the youth are not taking out withdrawals. One thing that I would like to note, what also is noted, that part of the withdrawals in Colombia, I just want to make a quick note here, is that there is a high withdrawal in Colombia, but part of the reason is because in Colombia specifically, they used a commitment account, and that is the youth were saving to a savings amount goal, and they had monthly deposit goals as well. And what we found is that at least 25% of those who closed their account had reached their deposit, had reached their savings goal. So this may account for part of the reason why they were withdrawing. One thing I would like to caution, and I won't go into it in too much detail, we can talk about it in questions, is notice that we do report on inactive accounts. I know that there's going to be some other presentations about issue of dormancy. I think it's important to note that an inactive account, it means that kids are not depositing, but it also means the kids are not withdrawing. So how we think about an inactive account, I think we have to give some consideration to. In YouthSave, I also want to caution, because accounts had really had only been open on average between 8 months and 13 months, depending on the country, and many banks don't even count dormancy until a year. So I think for youths particularly, we need to think about how we assess that. The other way that we measure savings is average monthly net savings. This is an important way to measure because it accounts for the length of the time that the accounts have been open. And so this is an average over the number of months an account has been open. This is also happens to be what we call our dependent variable. That is the variable that we use to measure associations with savings and significant levels with that. In terms of, so I want to go now into the youth characteristics of savings, in terms of what are the characteristics associated with savings. For youth, the main one that I really want to highlight here is that in all four countries, youth, younger youth tend to save more than older youth. This is, I think, an interesting finding. What we find is, as I mentioned before, part of it is because the young people tend to withdraw less. And it may also be that we've learned from other qualitative studies that the parents may be providing more financial support when the kids are younger. And as they get older kids have more expenses, and the parents may be, and guardians may be expecting them to take care of themselves. In terms of characteristics, product characteristics that are associated with savings, I'd like to make the first one is quite interesting. As you know, that account uptake was stronger when a co-signature was by a trusted adult. However, the youth are more likely to save if the parent is the co-signer. So again, we see this influence and importance of the parental involvement in savings. The other three I'll mention just briefly. As I said before, accounts were, the financial institutions use various marketing methods. So the media outreach and other ways, and youth who talked about how they learned about the account were more likely to save if they said it was through a friend or family or media. So because the financial institutions were targeting lower income communities, it may be that these other youth just had more money to save. We don't know that answer exactly. The other thing, in electronic access, very few people really used this, but I do think it was important to note that in Kenya, folks who used M-Pesa transacted more and saved more. And in Nepal, those who used the ATM also transacted and saved more. And finally, we had in Nepal, the financial institution used financial incentives at a certain period of time, and when we did an assessment on that, we found that those who took advantage of those financial incentives saved significantly more than those who did not, not even counting the financial incentive itself. Okay. The last thing I want to mention, Gina Cho is going to be talking about the Ghana experiment. But what I just want to mention, you may, as I mentioned earlier, that having financial services at the schools makes a big difference on account uptake. Through the experiment, we also learned that it also has an impact on deposits and also on savings. Gina is going to talk more about the experiment and give you more context for that, but it is an important element when we talk about how to facilitate access and savings for young people. I think this is one of the most important findings from our research is how we do this. We want to start early in life. I'm moving quickly because I know my time is running out, so my apologies, I'm talking a bit fast. But I think the key is that we need to get accounts open. The first thing is access. Once we get that, what we call plumbing in place, which is a term with a phrase that Michael Sheridan used, then we can think about the different strategies for the actual saving process, whether it's programmatic or product, other kinds of product features. In terms of starting early, age really makes a difference. These kids do save early. We should take advantage of that early time. In the United States, we're looking at starting from birth, accounts at birth. Children's development accounts is becoming a bigger topic, and we maybe can think about that. We do need to test further on the product characteristics, withdrawals and savings goals and incentives. These are strategies that need to be tested further. And then finally, the combination of offering financial education and financial services together, we see that that does work. And I guess what I always like to say is, how can you learn to read without the book? So if you have the account, that simply augments what you're learning in school, what you're learning in financial education. It makes it very, very relevant, which is a key piece for young people to make it very relevant for their lives in the future. So thank you very much.
Can you hear me?
Okay.
I will be looking at the Ghana experiment. And the main research question in the Ghana experiment was, will participation in new states improve financial capability, psychosocial education, and health outcomes? So what contextual, conceptual framework did we use to investigate this question? So what we looked at is, if youth participate in youth save, so if the intervention is rolled out to youth, will it increase psychosocial outcomes, right? So will it increase their aspirations? Will it increase their future outlook? And consequently, will it increase their financial capability? And how we are defining financial capability is the knowledge, the savings of youth. And will it increase financial well-being? So that is the financial capability pathway. The next one is educational pathway. If the intervention is rolled out, will it increase self-efficacy and expectations? Will it also increase parental involvement? And then will it improve school-related behaviors? And what we are talking about there is more hours spent on homework, better behavior at school, and will it ultimately improve performance in school. The intervention again, future outlook, increase future outlook, increase parental connections with their children, and monitoring as well. improve health perception. So condom use, perceived barriers to condom use and the like. And then will it increase health-related behaviors? So the design of the Ghana experiment, we really wanted to follow what the intervention looked like. So remember that the intervention is by HFC Bank, which is the financial institution that was in the Ghana experiment, and we had to follow the footprint of the bank. And HFC is in 8 regions of the 10 regions of Ghana. And so we randomly selected 100 schools in the 8 regions where HFC is. And then we randomly assigned 50 schools to the treatment and 50 schools to the control. Within the treatment, we had 2 intervention arms. The first one was marketing outreach. So the financial institution would go to the school and explain what the account was, which was the youth tailored account, and invite the students to come to the bank and deposit and do their transactions at the bank. They opened accounts at the bank. The first visit they had to the bank, to the school, and after that they didn't go back to the school. They just sent adverts. The second treatment arm was in-school banking. So the school, the bank would go to the school and introduce the account, but also do transactions together with the teachers and the students. So they would set up a bank in the school and have a mini bank within the school. We collected data at baseline, so before the treatment and end line, after the treatment. So what were the intervention features? So HFC Bank, as I've already explained, offered the youth tailored account, savings account, and basic financial education. Basic because the bank staff themselves would go in and just explain savings, postponement of consumption, and what that meant, and just simple transaction issues like filling out a deposit form, withdrawal, things like that. And the account came with an ATM card. This ATM card was only used to check balances. It was not used. Deposits could be made anytime. No withdrawals, like Lisa said, the first 3 months of account sign-up. And then withdrawal requires parents' presence. So this was a custodial account. And minors are not supposed to hold an account without an adult. So withdrawals were only done with a parent or a responsible adult present. So what is the plan for the statistical analysis? We use intent to treat approach. What this means is that everybody is included, whether they received the intervention or did not receive the intervention. We looked at the outcomes across the group. We calculated change scores. What that means is we looked at the means at baseline, looked at the means at end line, subtracted those to see what the differences were, and then compared them across the group. T-test for bivariate, chi-square for more than 2 group comparisons. At baseline, we had 6,267 youth. At end line, we had 4,289. The current analysis includes 4,289 youth. However, when we are doing analysis, sometimes within variables, there are missing cases, so the sample goes down. But just to show you that the base of the analysis is 4,289. Findings. So we tested all indicators within the main outcomes. Within the financial capability, we asked about savings, about deposits, how easy it was to use the bank, etc. Within health, we looked at risky sexual behaviors. Education, we looked at both school data and self-reported data. Psychological well-being, we looked at self-reported data. Like Ruth mentioned, we had mixed findings. Within the financial capability, we had positive effects. Within health, education, and psychosocial, we had mixed Now, I think I should mention here that there's a caveat. Most of the time when people say it wasn't statistically significant, they throw it out. That's not correct. Because when you see a positive trend, even if it's not significant, statistically significant, it still shows that there is an effect, there is an impact, although it's not statistically significant. So you'll see as I go through the slides that this is the case here. So what I present is either statistically significant or approaching significant. So the first question, did youth use banks to make deposits? So when we talk about treatment here, we combined marketing and in school. Baseline, we had 3% and line 13. For the control, we had 2% at baseline, 7% at end line. And this was statistically significant. The group differences were statistically significant. And if we separate them, in-school banking, marketing, and treatment, still it was statistically significant. The use and knowledge of an Edanso account by youth. Okay. So there was a question that we asked, have you heard of the Edanso account across the group? 35% of the control had heard of the account. 75 of the marketing, 81 of the in-school banking. Did you open an account? 15 of the control had opened an account. 29 of the marketing, 32 of in-school banking. Have you deposited in the Edanso account? 0, control, 9% marketing, 12 in-school banking. How much money do you have that belongs to you? So this is a question that we ask both at baseline and end line. And we see with the control, actually, all the groups had sort of a similar answer at baseline. So the mean of the money, and this is in Ghana cedis, was the same. At end line, control had 79, in-school banking had 166, and had 166. In-school banking had 78.87. Now, remember I said that we're doing comparisons across these three groups. If you look at the differences across these three groups, it's not significant. However, if you do bivariate comparison between control and marketing and in-school banking, it's statistically. How much money have you set aside to use sometime later? Similarly, marketing did well. And then it's the same story. Across, not statistically significant. Bivariate comparisons, it's statistical. With psychosocial outcomes, the intervention showed small but positive trends on orientation towards the future. So think of the conceptual framework. We talk about future orientation as one of the indicators to show whether the intervention had an impact on psychosocial outcomes or not. So all youth reported an increase in their orientation towards success, right? But it wasn't statistically significant. As you can see, they all started at around 52, but they ended up with very similar results. So it wasn't really different. However, like I said, there's a positive trend. It's going up, but it's for all. Intervention showed small but positive trend on perceived barriers to condom use. So this is one of the indicators we used. If you look at the report, we have more indicators, but I'm just giving you a bird's eye view of what we found. So again, marketing did the best. In-school banking was okay. Control was okay. So now, the going down is good, right? Because it's barriers. So it's not going up. Rather, it's going down because we want them to have less barriers to condom use at end line. So this is good. The decline is good, the decrease. So then we asked questions that would really tap into the youth-safe intervention increase risky sexual behaviors? Because the concern with practitioners is if you roll out a financial inclusion intervention, then youth will start engaging in sexual behaviors to find money to deposit, right? So we did this just to make sure that, to find out if this was the case. So we measured unwilling sex, paid sex, and condom use at the last sexual interval at end line. We didn't do baseline, we did end line just to check if this had an effect. Okay? So the light blue is yes, the dark blue is no. With the control, 19 said yes, they engaged in unwilling sex at end line 81. Marketing, 20 said yes at So yes, and then 80% said no. 15% said yes, 85% said no. Engagement in paid sex, 8% across marketing and control said yes, 92% said no. In school banking, 6 said yes, 94 said no. Condom use at last sexual intercourse, yes, in school banking 42, 31, 32. This is control. And then no, 58, 69, and 68. So in-school banking performed the best. What are the limitations of this study? Actual exposure to treatment is important, but it was different across schools because there was variation in engagement of bank staff. So some banks went more times to some schools and less times to other schools. So it wasn't the same across schools. And then, like you saw on the slide that showed that some control kids opened accounts, so there was treatment diffusion. And then for this particular presentation, we only used change scores across three treatment groups. What we'll do, what we're doing right now is really investigating how did youth perform different across these three groups. Were there some other factors that impacted better performance or less performance, success and less success, right? So implications for the research, it shows that early savings have promised for multidimensional impact on youth well-being. So there's that positive trend on education, on health and psychosocial well-being. However, we think that a longitudinal study to establish long-term effects of early savings will be better, because then we can look at these short-term impacts. Will they be sustained over the long haul? Policy, evidence that early savings have a multidimensional impact will give us alternatives for youth development policies, because this is a low-cost, high-impact intervention, and policies would rather have cost-effective interventions to impact youth development well-being. So this is a good study that shows evidence for that. Practice in terms of financial institutions and youth development organizations. In-school banking might use agency for financial inclusion for youth development in different domains. However, this study shows that marketing outreach might be an alternative, a robust alternative for in-school banking, for low-touch approach to financial inclusion. So financial institutions really want to see profit. So if they are not in banks most of the time, they can just go and introduce an account and let the students come to their banking halls and achieve the same outcomes. That would be a cost-effective way of doing it. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Gina. I'll invite Lissa and Gina to come join me up here, and I encourage all of you, too, to start thinking of your questions. Including those online. We'll be taking questions from our audience online as well. But I wanted to get us started with a few questions that I had about this. And certainly you've raised a lot of important issues and already started some of the thinking about what does it mean. But before we get into the implications, and we're going to have another panel, of course, where we can talk through more what is this, what we've learned from this project, the implications for our policy and practice. But I thought I'd start with a couple questions, and the first question's actually for Lissa. I'll let you. No, listen up. It's going to be a good one. Take notes. No, I was intrigued by what you were saying about inactive accounts. And we saw in that graph that there were quite a few countries with inactive or closed accounts. And as you mentioned, inactivity is defined as not making deposits. Can you tell us any more about which youth were likely to be actively depositing? Does this vary by gender or age or other characteristics? What do we know about that?
I think it's important because an inactive account, and let me clarify from that slide, we looked at inactive accounts for the past 6 months. So it wasn't for the past year, it's for the past 6 months. So it could be those percentages would be lower if we were looking at a whole year. The reason we did it at 6 months is because, like I said, the average account had really not been opened that long. And so I think it's a real caution in terms of thinking about that. I think it's a real caution because we're finding that sometimes savings occurs because they're not withdrawing. So they're putting money in, may not be a whole lot at a time, but if they're not withdrawing it, then it's increasing. And as I mentioned before, the younger children are actually depositing more and they're saving more. So there could be a correlation there. In terms of withdrawers, those that are more active are older, tend to be male, and to me, it's logical that the older youth particularly tend to have more expenses as they age over time. I think this has implications, too, in thinking about what kind of an account we would want for our young people. There may be an account that looks one way for the younger, and maybe you transition or have two accounts, one a transaction account later. I think these are all very important questions and strategies to consider.
So, again, do you have anything from the data to really give us more information about why younger people are saving more?
Well, like I said, data also show that they tend to withdraw less. So I think there is that that's saving more. I think that probably young people tend to get more support from their parents when they're younger. I do know that in the supplemental research that we did for the Ghana, we carried on and looked a little bit longer at the accounts. And I think the longer we can look at these accounts, the more information we're going to have that really begins to clarify more of these trends. It appears that when they save younger at younger age, and then they hit a point, and then really much older, they begin to save a little more, but that there is this gap between 13 and 16 where they're not quite ready to earn income, but they're still in their younger stages. So, this, as we've talked about in other meetings, segmentation by age begins to think about, okay, where are they in their age? What do they need at that time? Stage of development really might be an important consideration.
Thank you. So let's turn to Ghana then. And Gina, I have a question for you. And you were talking about all of the multiple different outcomes in different domains, including academic behavior, health behavior, and psychosocial in terms of optimism for the future. Can you comment any more on the implications of seeing multiple positive benefits associated with youth savings and that you're seeing positive trends across these various dimensions?
So like I said, it has policy implications. It has practice implications. So if we see that early savings has this multi-dimensional impact on different youth well-being areas, then we could start thinking about how do we ensure that kids have early savings, right? And if it can impact different areas of youth well-being, then voila, we have something that is very simple, but it's impacting different areas of youth well-being.
What do we know specifically about the gender differences in Ghana? You talked a lot about the differences between the various groups, but do we know anything about how it was different for girls versus boys?
So boys in Ghana save more than girls, which is not consistent with what we know in research, because mostly if you look at population council results, you look at most of the savings results that come out of sub-Saharan Africa, it's girls who save more than boys. But Ghana is the reverse. And now I'm speculating, we haven't really dug into this, but we think that it's because of the socialization of boys in Ghana. From a very early age, they are taught business acumen, they are taught how to save for capital towards small retail businesses, they are taught susu collection, they do that. So there is this culture of saving in Ghana, which is really targeted to boys because they're expected to take care of their families as they grow older. So speculation again, we think that's what is at play here.
Oh, that's very interesting. Thank you. So I just want to ask one more question before we turn it over to the webinar. So just a reminder to get those questions in, as well as people in the room here. But one might say then, when we look at some of these results, that perhaps they're not terribly convincing. Some accounts are inactive or people aren't actively depositing. Some countries or population groups show limited savings. And we're not really certain yet what the impact is on youth trajectories. So what would you say in response to this?
I would say it's too early to tell. I would keep iterating is, at least from the data that we currently have from May of 2014, if we continue and continue to look, we might see some changes over time. I think it's a little unfair to expect youth to have accumulated so much savings. And I think the question is, what is our expectation of the level of savings that children should have at a certain period of time? When you look at the transaction patterns, we see that most of the kids are not making deposits every single month. And is that okay or is that not okay? And if we do want them to deposit every single month, what kind of strategies do we need to in place to make that possible for them? It's very difficult for them to go and to the bank, make a deposit. Now, they may be saving at home. I know that in Ghana, for example, the kids actually, the girls and boys actually saved pretty equally, but that was the data that we have from the financial institution, not just savings overall. So I think these are really, really important questions, and I think we need to be careful about what expectations we're setting for our children.
Gina, what would you say about that specifically for Ghana, where we saw some similarity in some of the outcomes for the treatment groups versus the control?
So I think we should remember that this is an experiment. Right? It's not anecdotal. It's not just sitting with, youth and, you know, interrogating whether they are saving or not. It's an experiment. And in an experiment, if there's a positive trend, that shows that there's a difference between the intervention, group and the, and those that did not receive, intervention, then you start thinking that there is an effect. Right? And if it's positive, there are some that are statistically significant. That is huge. And if you look at 6,267 and look at statistical significance, then the treatment worked. It did work. It's just that if you look at education in the area of education, treatments take long. They don't take 2 months, 3 months, 4 months. Education, if you talk to any person who's from the School of Education or just working in education and does research in education, it takes longer to peak educational outcomes. With the psychosocial and the health, if you look at the health outcomes, for example, the indicators that we used at Endline, all of them are positive, right? And so that indicates that there's something that is happening psychologically with the kids that is impacting their well-being. So I do not think that someone can stand up and say it's not convincing, because not everything will be statistically significant. This, we looked at several indicators. And teasing that out, that's what we're doing right now, segmenting, going really into details about what does a successful youth look like? What is impacting that? Is it rural versus urban, is it age, is it gender, all that. So we will be producing more results on that. But I think that to say that it's not convincing would be misleading, because these are positive trends.
I'm sorry, I also just want to add that a focus of this initiative was inclusion. And I think we were quite successful in inclusion. I think the next step is how do we, once the accounts are open, how then do we help to encourage savings over time? But the very first step is just get these accounts open for these young people. And I think YouthSave has shown how that can happen in terms of policy, in terms of how you do co-signing on account, that maybe the age comes down. In India, you know, they drop the age to age 16 for account ownership, and how you provide access so that these young people can actually open the account. And I really don't want to, I want to stress really emphatically that low-income youth, girls, a lot of these underserved were able to participate in this, and a lot of it is because the banks went to them and they were able to open those accounts. That is the very first step that we need to overcome. Then we can talk about the saving strategies.
Great. Thanks so much. We're going to go first to Usman in the webinar and see if there's any questions online.
Yes, thank you. Good morning, everyone. Yes, we've been having some interesting comments in the comment chat. I'll share a couple of questions. One by Ekanath from Nepal. And you're saying that in their view, it is required to fix demand studies to establish a credit and the structure of youth financial needs may differ. I wanted to know from how to think what their perspectives are on this. And then there were like several comments regarding marketing. Indra, Vivian, and Carla, they wanted to know some a little more about what type of marketing was used and how that came about. Carla had a specific comment saying, if in-school banking was only in Ghana, how do the outcomes for school-based banking versus marketing take into account not only the different intervention but the different funds?
Great question. Do you want to?
Yes, the first
question
one was.
Was it about doing local
demand
assessment, market research, and what you specifically need in different markets?
Okay, there was some market research that was conducted early before as part of the assessing what the youth want and need, and this was conducted by Save the Children and other partners to assess that. That information was then provided to the financial institutions in collaboration with them to determine what kinds of product features would be used and what kinds of marketing strategies would be employed. So that was done at the local level. Second to that, in terms of your other question, what kinds of marketing was done? There were different things in different countries. Across the board, there was certainly the mass media, and there were also radio, TV. But there were also things that were done at the local level in the community. So there were some street dramas that occurred, and it really was very dependent on where the country was and what was most appropriate in that particular country.
Following up on that, Lisa, maybe I can ask you, do you, in your demand assessment, when you're looking at the transaction data, did it support that approach for saying there are specific demand differences in these various countries? Or did you more find commonalities across what the youth need? I think the comment from Nepal was, you know, we need to look at the specific features of the local context, the local market, and maybe what you specifically want are slightly different.
Sure. And I think that the financial institutions, you know, there are different branches in different locations, and those branches may have tweaked a bit the kind of outreach that they conducted in a particular local area. Across the board, they did some common things, but I think some of that can be tweaked depending on the particular community that they're doing outreach with.
Do you want to comment on the in-school banking question?
So I wasn't very clear what the question is. Are they asking that in-school banking was only done in Ghana, which is not true. It was done in other countries. But what's the question about Ghana in terms of
it was about if in-school banking was only in Ghana. So I think
yeah. It wasn't just in Ghana.
Just to clarify, the in-school banking was in the multiple countries, but we did the experiment where we were closely tracking the differences between in-school banking and the control group and the marketing outreach that was tracked very closely in Ghana. So that's a great clarifying question. So we'll take some questions from the audience as well, and Joy's there with a microphone. Just ask you to identify yourself, just introduce yourself where you're from before you post the question. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Candice. I'm an intern at Save the Children DC office. I work at the Hunger and Livelihood Department, and Rani Deshpande is my supervisor. So my question is about the clause that is there that the children cannot take away their money for the first 3 months they have saved. So do you think this clause has kind of like scared some of the children away from opening their accounts? Because, I mean, these are poor people, and not having access to their money for like 3 whole months is a huge factor for them. And so, I mean, our basic purpose is to create as much impact as we want, as we can. And then do you think kind of like reducing this amount, or maybe just reducing this loss altogether, would encourage more children to open these accounts? What do you think? Also, is there an annual fee for opening this account?
So maybe Rani can speak more to this because she was more involved with the financial institution. But from the research point of view, if you look at what has the evidence that is there up to this point in time, restrictions are one way of increasing savings, right? So if you restrict withdrawals the first 3 months, you are able to tease out whether restriction can help savings or not. I know that from a practical point of view, it's like, okay, why are you restricting withdrawals? Because that's why we want kids to have access to banking mechanisms, because we want them to be able to transact, right? So I think from a research point of view, that was helpful to just look, because if you look at the FDA data in Ghana, there was a positive trajectory and a consistent, sustainable trajectory in terms of saving. But with the other countries, it was going up and down because there was no, they didn't have that restriction. So from a research point of view, it's helpful to see whether if you put in these features, will it help kids save? But from a practical point of view, it's counterproductive, maybe. So yeah.
Great. We'll take another question from the audience. I see lots of hands.
Hello, my name is Abdul Chen. I'm an independent consultant. I'd like to follow up on Lisa's presentation showing the targets in four countries, how they were reached. I'd like to know what was the difference in your experience between Colombia and, for example, Kenya, where Colombia, the targets were underreached, it seems like. Thank you.
Sure, thank you. I was debating in the presentation whether I had time to talk about that, and I decided I didn't, so I'm glad you asked that question. You will see that in YouthSave, each financial institution had targets set for what they wanted to reach in terms of number of accounts open. And you saw that there were two extreme cases. In Kenya, they opened way more accounts than what the target was, and in Colombia, they opened way less. And my speculation on that is that this has with access. And that is that in Kenya, this was a new product, and the young people were very excited about it. In Colombia, there was actually another product that had been around for about 20 years. It was a transaction account, and still exists, I think it was, not a savings account, and some of that transaction account was much more flexible and didn't have a lot of those withdrawal restrictions, which we were talking about. In addition to that, some of the other variables here is that the financial institution's representatives actually knew more about that other account, so they might have promoted it more. So there's several variables that could have been involved in that for why that is the case. I will tell you that subsequent to that, the financial institution was not going into the schools at the time, and I can show a graph that shows actually when they started going into the schools, account uptake went up. And there is some relationship there. Going forward, I don't know where they stand today, but at the time they were talking about having both a commitment, what they call a commitment account, a savings account, and then also a transaction account, so that those could be shared by the young person and used one way for the one and another way for the other. And I think the big question here is, what's the purpose of the savings account? Is it to save or is it to transact? We have transaction accounts and then we have savings accounts. And it is hard as a young person to say, well, I'm going to put my money in here, but wait, I want to be able to get to it. Actually, as I'm older, I feel the same way. I want to be able to get to my money. But I think we have to think about that from a business case as well as in supporting the young person to continue to increase their assets.
Great. Thanks, Lisa. I'm going to suggest that we take a few questions and then we can respond to them as a group. So let's take some from the back of the room there, maybe. Oh, and we have Usman over here on the webinar. Do you have some questions there, Usman?
Yes, I'll quickly ask a couple of questions before we move back to the audience. Will Helmana wants to know, what were the reasons for the large number of youth that dropped out of the study? And Larissa wants to know, why was the reach in the SADA zone in Ghana, northern region, so limited? Was it access to banking institutions?
Great question. And we'll take one from the back here as well, and then we'll let the panel answer some.
Hey, Susan Rogers from Creative Associates.
Yeah, I'm glad the question was asked about, you know, what had to do with the dropout, and did the researchers really try to take a look at any significant differences between those that did drop out and stayed with the study, because that can introduce tremendous bias. My other question, similar in terms of Gina, how did you do assignment to the two different treatment arms? Obviously, our best kind of design is random assignment, but that probably couldn't be done here. How did you assure that the individuals, both in the treatment arms as well as control, had a degree of being equivalent? My other question was, to me, there were some obvious factors that maybe could have been controlled for here regarding the savings piece, and that is the household income of the family of the children, and the extent that the family itself had savings accounts. Those seem obvious ones. A fourth question is for you, Gina, regarding the HIV piece. There's been tremendous literature done on factors that affect our condom use on last sexual intercourse. And while I think the structural piece of youth, you know, having more money could make a difference, the literature says there's some solidly other explanatory variables that you really, in my opinion, need to control for before we would, you know, try to say that the savings piece was really a significant factor. Probably a little late now, but I, in the future, in terms of studying that, I would recommend that.
Great, thank you. There's multiple very, very good questions in there. Maybe we'll let Gina respond to. There's several questions on the Ghana experiment.
I hope I can remember all of them.
I can
so
help
the first
you too.
One, okay, thank you. The first one was about attrition. There was about 2,000 who were calling dropped out of the sample. So think about this. The baseline was conducted a year before treatment, and then the end line was conducted about three years after the treatment. So that was years, right? So we had, what I didn't talk about is these schools were junior high schools. So they are transitioning to senior high school. So it was difficult to track all 6,000, right? But I think Issa, who is our partner in Ghana from the University of Ghana, did a good job trying to follow the kids. What we're trying to do moving forward is to find all the 6,000. But yeah, that's why there was a dropout. But going to the last Issa's question, this is the report from the Ghana experiment. If you look at it, we actually look at the differences between those who dropped out and those who are in the sample at the end, and there's no difference. So if you look at the report, we go into all the statistical issues and really look at if there's a difference or not, and there's not. And then the second question?
I was going to say that one of the questions from the online group was about the limited outreach in northern Ghana. Was there a reason?
Yes, that's
for that?
The second question. Why not the north region? So remember I said that we had to follow the footprint of the financial institution. And the financial institution is in only 8 regions of the 10 regions of Ghana. And so that's why we were not in the 2 upper regions of Ghana, because the bank is not there. There's no presence from the bank. And then there was random assignment. Yes, we did random assignment. If you look at the second slide in my presentation, we actually randomly assigned from the school to within the school to the 2 different arms. So everything was done with random assignment. And then you talk about control, right? Controlling for household income, savings within the household. So if you remember again, I said this is bivariate. We are just looking at change scores on all these things. What we are doing in the next phase is really going in and looking at all the things that we are talking about. So what we'll do is, if we segment the sample according to location, for example, we might even do propensity score matching, where we make sure that they are on the same level, and then we introduce all those control factors that we're talking about to see the outcomes and look at effects. So we are doing multiple analysis in the next phase. This is just for the bivariate.
I hope I'm not the only one in the room that got a thrill of excitement at the thought of more statistics.
Okay. Yeah, and there was also a question on the HIV/AIDS.
So yes, again, this was just to look at condom use. So we have experts in HIV/AIDS, I think some HIV/AIDS as well. This was not to look at effects. We're looking at what happened to the kid. So if we are looking at effects of the treatment on HIV/AIDS, would actually have a different conceptual framework. This was not for that. It was just to look at other kids engaging more in risky sexual behavior. It has nothing.
Okay. What was the question? Ask you to use the microphone, please. We've got people online who won't hear.
In terms of condom use on last sexual intercourse, you did take a look at the effect of the savings piece, correct?
No, it wasn't effect. That's what I'm saying. It was end line. It was just to look at what happened. Yes, uh-huh. It's not effect.
Okay, so there's not policy implications here.
No.
Got it.
Great clarification. I think we had a question up here as well.
I'm the USAID in the Office of Education. I had a question regarding your indicators, your education indicators, and just from hearing your answer from your last question, that it was across 3-year period, so that you did this impact evaluation. So I'm kind of curious to know, one, what education indicators you were looking at for the education outcome, and it's a little surprising for me after 3 years, maybe it's the dollar threshold from which, like, retention, it didn't impact in some way, retention or absences or things of that sort.
So let's just take another question first. Thanks, Gina. We had one up here.
Monique Cohen. I'm very interested. Everybody talked about the relationship between financial capability and communication and that it was an important variable. But nobody really answered the question, what was the financial education? What was important and how did the changes happen? I wonder if you can elaborate. And I'm particularly interested in how much of the education was classroom-based. Because classroom-based financial education is not as quite controversial and is not seen as very successful in changing behaviors.
Thank you. Usman, do we have any more questions from online before we... Okay. We have one more here in the room and then we'll... give it back to the panel.
Good morning. My name is Zajrap Chepi. I'm from Provence, based in Tunisia. So my question is, for financial institutions, and especially for active accounts, is financial institutions are providing any incentives? And the second question for Kenya and Ghana case, in the future, do you target the informal savings groups? Thank you.
Yeah, so there were a couple questions about education indicators and also about the financial education and what that looked like. Was it classroom-based?
So with the education indicators, 15 minutes is very short to really go into what happened. So if you look at the report again, we actually give... a detailed discussion on how treatment was rolled out. So if I say 3 years after treatment was rolled out, it was different in different places. So some received one, some received zero, others received just before we got end line. So it's very differential. So the impacts really are not 3 years after. So the intervention was not uniform rolled out at the same time, right? We even lost some folks. So that's why, that's why we are not talking about 3 years as the period of intervention for educational indicators. So if you look at the report again, it will give you details of what. The second question was about financial education, financial capability, and the classroom-based versus other mechanisms of delivery of financial education, right, Monique?
Okay.
So in the Ghana experiment, if we go by the Ghana experiment, I think Lisa can talk about the other three countries. It was very basic by bank staff, just talking about how do you fill out a deposit slip and all that. I think I should leave Rani first to talk about it, and then maybe I can talk about effects.
Sure. So I'm actually going to
take advantage of the opportunity to plug another paper that just came out by Dasha Kotina, where we did basic pre and post comparisons of changes in knowledge, skills, attitudes, and behaviors among the kids that did take the Save the Children sponsored financial education, some of which was classroom based and some of which was via street theater and FMS and what have you. And we don't have a counterfactual, so it does not rise to the level of evidence of some of these studies that we're looking at today, but it does show clear effects on indicators of knowledge and skills and attitudes and behaviors as well. More kids saved more, and they especially seem to imbibe, really internalize information because we did a pre-test at the beginning of the education, a post-test right at the end of the education, and then a post-post-test anywhere from 1 to 18 months after. And the knowledge that stuck really seemed to be the more technical knowledge. So not that savings is good. Kids knew that savings was good to begin with. But how do you open a bank account? How old do you have to be? How do you calculate an interest rate? The things that are not common sense were the indicators that moved the most and stuck the longest.
So with the Ghana experiment, we did not get into the financial education. But we do have some variables that we might look at moving forward.
Also add about that when we think about financial education, oftentimes it is classroom-based, but remember that even the marketing strategies that were employed include street dramas. Those are educational as well. There's lots of different ways financial education was presented. Parents also were given some seminars. So this was a lot of different activities that were happening. What didn't happen is we didn't test causally for each one of those types of interventions to see if there was one particular way that worked better than another. Where we did do a test was in Colombia. It wasn't with the Youth Save Savings account, but it was with their secondary account, their other account, their transaction account, Tuti Cuenta. And in that, we looked at text messaging to the youth account holders. We used financial education text messages and also deposit reminders. And in that experiment, we find that deposit reminders actually are more effective than financial education text messages specifically. And on corollary to that is that the deposit reminders also encouraged not withdrawing as part of the savings process rather than just continuing to deposit. So there's some interesting pieces to that. I think that the text messaging offers a really interesting way forward as a very cost-effective way to reach youth. I know that in previous studies that we have done, reminders in other way have been very, very useful. Even getting the account statement on a monthly basis to see in match savings programs, you get to see how your money is accruing. That is its own form of encouragement. So there are lots of ways that we can think about how to encourage that, but and because that also is really a form of financial education. So I think looking at ways to streamline how we do financial education is certainly a worthwhile endeavor.
Great. Thanks so much to both of you. I think there was one last question, which we'll just answer quickly because we're running out of time. But it was about the incentives from the financial institutions. I think also a follow-up on it was, were there savings groups involved? And I think I know the answer to this one, but I think my job is to turn it over to you to answer it.
I think I mentioned in one of the slides where we did see savings associated with a particular product characteristic, it was in Nepal. They did have financial incentives that were offered for about a seven-month period. And during that time, cash financial incentives. And where we see that happening, we did see statistical significance for the young people who did get those incentives. Now, we need to tease out more about what is it, can you say that the young people were more likely to participate and therefore, or did those cash incentives, were they an encouragement to save? We still need to, I think there's much more research that needs to be done on that, but it is as, you would say, is a positive trend, and I think it's something that we definitely need to explore. So the one financial institution did do that. We did talk about match savings at one point in time. We did not employ that. There are certainly lots of different strategies. There are some, not financial institutions only, but lots of programs who do top-ups for if you get a good grade. there's lots of ways that you can employ that, which is its own form of incentive.
Okay, so I think I'll just wrap up by just echoing that these USAID did not use savings group approach, but stay tuned. The MasterCard Foundation is doing a lot of work in savings group, including savings group for youth. So keep an eye on our website, and we'd be glad to share some of our learning in that area. So I'm going to wrap up now and thank the panelists, Lisa and Gina. Thank you so much. I think it was really interesting and great to have it translated into a format that we can think about as practitioners and policymakers. And I think it's a great example of really working on research that is applicable to our programming areas and our approaches. So thank you very much.
So I'm going to invite everyone to a 15-minute stretch break, and we'll get started back here at 11 o'clock, all right? So there's still food and breakfast in the back. And I know for webinar participants, feel free to continue the conversation.